Hi, everybody. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Halsey, and I'm a part of the in-store staff and the event staff at White Whale Bookstore. And I just want to say that White Whale Bookstore is thrilled and honored to help Joan E. Bauer and Christopher Collins virtually host the 2021 Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. Our lineup for this week, week four, features Jose Padua, Michael Sims, Matthew Usia, and Bob Wallachy. And I am just so excited for this reading. And I wanted to say that Sheila Scolante, unfortunately, was unable to be with us due to a family emergency. So our thoughts and hearts are with Sheila and her family at this time. So just a little bit about White Whale quickly. White Whale Bookstore is a family-owned general interest independent store located in the Bloomfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. We're doing lots of other virtual readings, book conversations, launches, workshops, and more. And we're open for browsing, curbside pickup, and shipping. You can find out all about those things on our website, which is whitewhalebookstore.com. So a few events coming up that we think you might be interested in if you're here tonight. On Wednesday, June 16th at 7 p.m., we're thrilled to celebrate four recent books from West Virginia University Press. In a party for some and a launch for others, we'll be joined this June by Joffrey Hilsebeck, author of American Vaudeville, Renee K. Nicholson, author of Fierce and Delicate, Essays on Dance and Illness, Sean Slifer, author of So Much to Publishing, 1969 to 1979, and Disha Filya, author of The Secret Life of Church Ladies and recent winner of both the 2020 and 2021 Story Prize and the 2021 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Then on Thursday, June 17th at 7 p.m. Eastern time, we're looking forward to a poetry reading with new friends and old faves, including several authors from Black Lawrence Press, PJ Sandella, Ways to Beg, Alan Cesaro, Pinata Theory, Connor Bracken, The Enemy of My Enemy is Me, and Kara Knickerbocker, Next to Everything That is Breakable. On Saturday, June 19th at 7 p.m. Eastern time, it's June's Laser Cat Phaser Cat reading. And this week we'll be hearing work from RJ Gibson, Ma Shinewin, and Maggie Anderson. Then on July 8th, which is a Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern time, we're thrilled to virtually welcome Carter Sickles to Pittsburgh to celebrate the recent release of The Prettiest Star in paperback. And he'll be joined by Nick White, author most recently of Sweet and Low. And you can find out more about them and other readings as well at whitewhalebookstore.eventbrite.com. So just a quick note on our Zoom settings, you'll be automatically muted and your video will be off for the duration of the reading, just so that it's easier for us to focus on the readers. And we'll have a moment at the end for all of you to turn on your audio and your video to clap for our audience members. And then for best viewing, we recommend hiding non-video participants. So if you click on view in the upper right-hand corner of the video section of the screen and click hide, non-video participants. So the chat in this Zoom meeting will be activated for you to only message the host, which is me, and you will not have the ability to message other users or to post public messages, but I will send the chat log to our readers along with the other Zoom files. So if you want to send them nice notes or kind thoughts, you can send them to me. And we do have Zoom's live closed captioning available this evening. You can toggle it on and off by clicking the CC button at the bottom of your screen or clicking on the ellipses, which says more, and then going to the live transcript section. So, and that is everything for me on the logistic end. I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to Chris, who gives us absolutely phenomenal intros.
Hi, thanks Halsey. Thanks to Halsey and White Whale for again hosting the Hemingway's Poetry Series tonight. Again, we couldn't be doing this year without them. We missed last year entirely, had to cancel the season. It was heartbreaking for both myself and Joan. So we're really just so happy that White Whale stepped in this year and really saved our season. And that way we get to present these amazing poets to you tonight. Unfortunately, Sheila Scolante, who was originally supposed to be with us tonight, can't be here due to a family emergency. So our thoughts and best wishes are with Sheila and her family tonight. So thanks for joining us. So my wife grew up right outside of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, in a town called Fairfield. very close to Gettysburg. And when her younger sister graduated from high school, it was known that she, my wife's sister, was going to be attending Pitt in the fall. So as she approached the stage to get her diploma from the principal leaned in and said to her, "Stay out of Hemingway's." And I think that's great. I think that it's great that this poetry series is associated with such a disreputable spot. Poetry needs that. I know myself and Joan will be glad to be back in that very dank, claustrophobic, weirdly cut in half back room with the beer spill and the weirdness. It adds a lot to the poetry, I think. It's a fitting setting for what we do, because poetry should be a bit disreputable. It should be something you warn people about a little bit, I think. So I just heard that story the other night from my wife. I didn't know that. I thought that was something I needed to share, certainly with Joan, but with the rest of you. I won't say much more. I do want to say that I hope everybody had a great Pride last week. The series wasn't able to properly acknowledge or celebrate. So I'm going to read two very short poems to you. They come from the LGBTQ Fiction and Poetry from Appalachia anthology, edited by Jeff Mann and Julia Watts. This was published last year, I believe, by West Virginia University Press. So two quick poems by two writers with Pittsburgh associations, and then we'll get on with the evening. Thanks for listening. Thanks for coming out. And thanks to Joan. Thank you, Joan. Okay, this first poem is by Aaron Smith, poet Aaron Smith. It's called "There's Still One Story." Or no, not that one. Blanket, I'm sorry. Blanket. Does it matter to you that it's snowing in West Virginia? And people keep saying the word blanket. Over the cars, a blanket, and the streets are blanketed, and the schools are closing under blankets of wet snow. I'm sitting under a blanket, missing every place I've lived. Pittsburgh's edges, Boston's proper sidewalks, the cold shoulders and steel jaws of New York. Do you remember our last walk? The leaves were sticking to the ground. The park was orange and oddly warm, and people were laid out on blankets, little islands, little worlds of what they loved, wanted to love, or no longer loved, but were trying, for whatever reason, to hold on to. And the last poem I'm going to read real quick, by the poet Maggie Anderson. And this is called "My Father and Ezra Pound." I drank iced tea with whiskey in it, smoked Salems and read small poetry books on the cement slab we called a back porch, wedged into a chair made from a broken barrel and painted bright orange. Pound had just died, and also my father. I could trail a silly thought for hours. For example, when I first read Pound, he was alive, silent in St. Elizabeth's, and then I read him dead. Did this make any difference? And what about Dad? The year before he died, he wrote 50 poems and 6 plays, collaborating with his lover, the college business manager who had AIDS, though we didn't know it then. My glass of tea was dark and didn't show the liquor, but my breath did when she kissed me. I was writing my early poems of vegetables and grief, reading the 4 quartets and Algernon Swinburne for my exams, mixing martinis in a chrome shaker for my father's house. All those years it took him to work out whom he loved, and he waited until the end to break his silence. Envelopes of blue mimeograph pages, his legacy. Once a week, my uncle called to see how I was doing. My father was his only brother, so pretty good, I always said. I listened to The Doors and Joplin. This was the 70s. I was 23 years old, turning the thin pages of the cantos. No one came to visit. We had 2 dogs. We needed nothing then except each other, and that we needed all the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that intro, Chris. That was incredible. And our first reader of the evening is Robert Wallachy, or Bob Wallachy.
All right, now I can speak. I want to echo Chris's thanks to Halsey and Anna and the folks at White Whale that are keeping poetry alive in this like really weird and kind of fracturing, you know, disparaging time. I wanted to start my reading off with this poem that I'm starting all my readings off with now, because we're talking before the reading about people that are no longer with us and how difficult of a year it's been for us. And I lost a friend, a lot of us lost a friend who's an amazing person, amazing woman, amazing poet. And this elegy is for her. It's called If You Were Here, for Barb Dahlberg. You would have mentioned the crocuses poking up in my neighbor's lawn as if from nothing. You would have remembered the ornamentals in my lawn, their lushness, before their end of season cut down. It's early spring, but the air is frozen into my bones, my wind-whipped face. But you wouldn't have mentioned winter, or the hair you've lost, what's happened inside your body. Today, for some reason, I want to tell you about the possum I stopped for, the one I missed with my car on the way to work in the dark, of the cat I saw on the way home, dead, frozen in a half scream in a stranger's yard. There is nothing beautiful about death, just this space between air and a reason to keep going. If you were here, I'd ask you what that is. Perhaps there's an answer in the periwinkle planters that adorn our house, the cardinals that have come back to the mimosa branches as if they've forgotten something, something so important, it's worth staying here, worth searching. So moving on from that, I want to switch gears and read a new poem. And I'd like to say before I start this poem that those of you who know Michael Sims know what a wonderful poet he is. And some of you may not know what a wonderful ambassador to poetry he is as well. And he's been a wonderful support to my work and the work of a lot of poets and his amazing journal, Vox Populi, as well. And this poem was published there. It's called Mind. 500 feet below ground, in a place we'll never see again, we sweat water lines, pipe in bathrooms, and showers for miners. I shine torch flames to light my way out of a ceiling lined with mottled rock and down dugout tunnels of stone. They haven't bothered painting the walls because they'll bulldoze everything we've done. Every faucet handle and shower head, the dizzying maze of copper lines, every offset drain snaking through walls and floors, carrying the days of our exhaustion, the arthritis in our knees, and all the beers we can throw back in 6 weeks to numb the pain of our breaking. No one ever said we'd be leaving the ghost of our bodies here in Ace's bar, in the 60-hour work weeks, in the slow walks through the mud to our trucks. They'll bury us after the miners have laid bare the earth, clean the coal under the mountain we drive down, swing wrecking balls into the men's and women's rooms, caving in break rooms and bunk beds and the extension ladder staircase. We'll keep the black air we breathe in and the memory loss. Remember the sounds of those clicking cars in the darkness, the rush of water when we turn the valves on, how every joint held. I sort of had the auspicious experience of getting a new job, being hired to work at a hospital right before COVID. And I have a couple poems about those experiences. This is one of those poems. It's called Fires. 9 p.m. in the psych ward. and I'm passing through keypad doors, a taped sign that says elopement risk, be cautious. And my mind drifts to Forbidden Love and that Robert Browning poem. But the only light here is lunar and cold in room 3311, where a woman ripped the outlets from the walls. We've removed her, nurse says. I've never seen anything like it, to do that with your bare hands. I'm smoldering, thinking of her fingernails, one wedged like a coin in the drywall, of my own hands seared raw with solder burns, the steel stud I rubbed past in a ceiling reaching for black holes, a soil stack carrying sickness. And suddenly it's natural to imagine reaching into a wall for a sharp fire. Last week, on the plane trip back from Florida, before we landed, before we knew we'd be okay, the plane was shaking like a fever and the sky tumbling gray into rain, and I'm reading a magazine to get my mind off this. The page opening to the article on electricity in the body. How a person can put out 2,000 watts when sprinting. But how many for a sister screaming for meds when the night took down power lines, wet roads, the hospital flashing dark, tree limbs sparking? How many for quarantines and layoffs, for murder hornets and sex, screaming our heads off at the Phish concert, guitar solos like transformers on fire? And what about the light switch at the real estate office? My mother sitting there, pen in hand, her hair a frazzled wire. How much for the lamplight we left on in her empty house? We're driving away with a U-Haul and windows stripped of everything, the way the sky broke on the way home before the rain, all that fracturing light. One more hospital poem. This is called The Fluttering. I'm stumbling out of the dark and back down again, winding onto the rutted valleys of the Mon, ass crack of the world, and broken roads past AJ's crane and 100 other rusted necks, reaching for a sky I never wanted to know. Exhaust blowing fog into a morning, the shade of bruised and regret, passing lane headlights flashing slow like tired ghosts. No one here will ever say they ever wanted this life. Only this flare of sore wrists, the years of twisting pipes, diving into the dark of underneath, of bleakness. In every way, this is an act of disappearance. But this muted morning, the men from Local 27 are chatting about the weather woman's breasts, while outside, the air is losing its memory. A rash of embers, flaming lights around the corner by Irwin Iron, where steel is burning and the men there breathe it in. Today, I've made it here again, to this five-story building, to crawl under another dirty sink, into the wrecks of leaks, in ceilings where confetti of rust rains into my eyes. We're all one day closer, the 64-year-old plumber tells me. And I think about my father, the same age as me, and a year away from his last heart attack, the fast flutter in the center of my chest as I stand atop a ladder, peer into the dark above a wet wall, click my flashlight on. So I'm gonna read a couple poems from my new book, Fountain, and from Main Street Rag Press, which just came out. So this is my virtual, unofficial kind of launch for that. And this poem still has one of my favorite titles. It's called Rocking Mahjong at Panera. For weeks now, I'm watching the strangers gather. What's your name? And I'm teaching electrical now at Westinghouse. Gertrude sets her oxygen down by the divorcee. Men and women coming alone and staying. I think drugs, think alcohol. The grandmother's son, a model in New York, hasn't talked to her in weeks. I watch purses and plastic bags spill open in small explosions. They snap tiles down, rocking mahjong for the lonely. I'm watching them and not thinking of the last time my father sat down with us at the dinner table, my mother blowing up the dust off a caved-in box and setting it down, would go over the rules to life and Clue, Monopoly. I emptied the box full of pastel bills, the red plastic hotels, houses small as pills. None of us could tell our father was dying. We were here to learn the meaning of want and to gather assets, be transformed into silver dogs and rocking horses, building lives away from our own, trying to make it one more go round, pass go, collect another 200. In ripped chairs, we hunched our backs and stroked our chins like fake Carnegies and Fricks, under the glare of the kitchen light where my father sat in the last year of his life, shaking his hands, dice banging in his fist. He breathed into the hole and let it go. This next poem I wrote, was talking to my mother about experiences that she had and relatives, and because I regret I never went to the family reunions that a lot of my relatives went to, because I never really learned about our relatives. So she always told me the story about how she hated Lake Erie and like, why do you hate Lake Erie? So this poem is about why she hates Lake Erie. She's thinking of her mother in 1949, the year the boat took a nosedive, storms lifting her nine-year-old world above the undulating lake, white-knuckling scuff seats. Hang in there, honey, my mother said. And whatever was inside her poured out in a rush. She's older now, but her same shipwrecked memories keep coming at us in waves. How the basements in Butler Street flooded, the fire that took her mother's house. I don't want to add to the aftermath of my day here when the Caesar salads arrive. Everyone eating the hot potato soup when my niece announced her favorite bath and body scent is thunder and rainforest. She loves the water and musicals. The swell of her voice lifts and falls like current as she talks about the concert she went to last night, glowing as she combs the blonde waterfall of her boyfriend's hair with her palm. They fit into each other like designer gloves. Everything that hasn't happened is waiting for them. Off the exit behind the restaurant, the last phone call, the breakup dinner, the long drive alone to college. Now she's talking about her new job. I lock people in rooms and they get clues. They have to figure out how to get out of the submarine. There's a shark coming in 30 minutes. You have to imagine it. People scream. It's fun. Everything that can kill her gathers around her like water. Keep sitting here, I want to say. Let's eat together. A little longer and say nothing. Wait for the rain to fall and the wind to take down trees. Every crack in the darkening sky is a gunshot that hasn't found us. Let's watch the flood from right here. The blur of this life and the waves come breaking. There was a word for this. We've already swallowed it, along with the lobster and the herb-crested salmon, saying, taste this. Instead of, my cancer's back, or I've lost my job, they're telling me I need the surgery. We dig deep into our plates, scrape them clean, argue about the check, saying, let me, no, let me, I got this, no, let me, it's my turn. Two more poems. Recently sold my mother's house, and I'm so thankful because she's in a place now where I don't have to worry. I don't have to worry about an old house. So this is about selling her house. It's called In the Beginning. There were 50-foot pines and a spike plant, Our Lady of the Broken Cobblestones, and a path to her house splayed with needles and the plastic grotto she came with from Rite Aid. My mother's backyard is a pilgrimage to every dropped leaf and seedling, pizza flyers and tinsel still taped to her railing from last Christmas. I'm selling her house over the phone as I steal one last look through her sun-flooded windows, the old bones of her hardwood floors visible from the street. My mother is on the other line making time for me between Saturday Mass and the domino playoffs. She's sipping Zinfandel at Sunset Crossing Apartments, where everything is becoming new again. The insurance papers she can't find. The name of the restaurant and her doctor's appointment lost in the fog of her previous life. And the one I imagined for her, I've just picked her up for breakfast. And there'll be no medications to forget to take. No questions left unsaid about her tests. How much time she has left. I've canceled my ocean vacation, so I'm sitting at home watching webcams of the Atlantic, boardwalk traffic and the splash of current. If I leap into my laptop screen, I can feel the shrapnel of shells against my feet, fragments of bone immaculate as cracked pottery. Outside, I stand up from the table. My mother is speechless, staring at the shore. She's forgotten her fear of water, so she stands with me in awe of the crashing wall, all that wet pulling. And we're near that hotel, the one that sits next to the kite shop, with that eagle still tied off on the rail. And there's a song playing. It'll come to me. Just now, I can't remember. Thank you all for listening. I have one last poem. And as I see, Jason Irwin is here, and this poem I wrote for him, and this is sort of like my response. He wrote this like amazing barbershop poem, so I always wanted to write a barbershop poem. So this is mine. It's called Classic Cuts. Sideways hat and tattooed hands. I watch Ace, the 30-something barber I found via the internet in Lincoln Road, down the gravel runoff behind the dollar store and cut rate beer. Ace asks how I found them, and we talk about old school barbers, how you can't find them anymore. I think about Jerry, where I used to go, the 80-something grandpa who called me Long Shanks, even though I was bald. Told the same stories every time about his World War II bride, beautiful and flaking apart on the unframed photo on the wall. Hit it just the rabbit ear so all of us watching, waiting, could watch the big college football game. Pitcher shaking each time a neck was buzzed, the hum and the old man smell of aftershave and talc slapped on shaved skin and laughter. Jerry asking me if I could trim that jacked up beard of mine. I learned of his death from the pile of papers outside his shop, and Ace talking about it, his flat screen blasting People's Court and commercials for hover rounds and Mucinex. Driving home past the closed True Value Hardware in a vacuum shop, I wonder if anyone will remember me, stop somewhere, and tell stories of how things used to be, the better days when I was here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bob. That was incredible. So our next reader is Jose Badua.
Hi, I'm it's great to be here. I'm going to start with a poem that's a request from the one of the last times I read in online for Pittsburgh. I hope maybe in the next year or so I'll be able to actually read in Pittsburgh. But until then, this is pretty good. This first one is called American Sadness. Of all the sadness in the world, there's nothing that can compare with American sadness. When America is sad, the whole world weeps. Whenever one American is sad, at least two non-Americans somewhere else in the world consider the possibility of ending it all. When 100 Americans are sad, wars are fought in faraway lands for the great purpose of making these 100 Americans happy again. When 1 million Americans are sad, every flag in America droops and slides an inch and then another inch down the flagpole, and nothing can stop this descent until bold, confident smiles return to these Americans' faces. American sadness, let's make it clear, is exceptional. Unlike what you may have heard, it doesn't always talk softly, but it always carries a big stick, because no one is sad the way an American is sad. No one drags his feet through the dullness of a day or walks with her eyes looking downward quite as sadly as an American who feels sad because America is losing a battle, coming in second, or washing ashore with empty pockets and bad breath. America, of course, American sadness, of course, is the greatest sadness in the world. Do not look it in the eye unless your intention is to make amends. Do not settle for a knowing grin or a sliding into place of the proper order of thought or things. Work hard, do your best, and fight whenever a fist is called for or a bomb needs to be dropped upon a civilian population whose greatest misfortune is not being American. But above all, keep American sadness at bay like a ship that wrecks offshore through instability or for fault of navigation. Let's remember to keep America happy. Let's keep America entertained. And this next one, it's a little lighter, but it still hits some of the same kind of targets. This is called Robert Frost. And this is actually, I always say this, it's actually pretty much true. In the 90s, I decided I needed to spend more time thinking about my career as a poet. So when my friend Sharon told me there was a poet's party at Stephen's apartment, I decided I should attend. There was a bar nearby, so I went there first. The bartender there was a friend of mine. I had a lot of friends who were bartenders, not as many as the poet friends I had, but if I'd ever decided to change careers, there were people in the business I could talk to. I talked to a woman who had the eyes of a psychic and was disgusted about something. I was fascinated, but being a poet, I had to leave to be with the poets at the poet's party. When I knocked and Stephen himself answered the door, I saw a room full of poets holding drinks, smoking cigarettes, talking about poems and books and concepts and all the beautiful things in the world. And I loved them all and everything they thought about so much. And I was out of my mind by then, not with grief or disgust, but with beauty. And there was nothing else for me to do except say, "You're an asshole," to Tom, to Amy, to Ed, to Robert, to Paul, to Ken, to John, to Charles, to Kim, to Mike, to Stephanie, and in case I missed anyone, declare, "Everyone in this room is an asshole." The next day I ran into Tom on the street and Tom asked me, "So am I still an asshole?" And Tom's hair was swaying with the wind, even though there was no wind, and the salt and pepper in his mustache fell lightly to the sidewalk as children walked by because it was Sunday and they were doing Sunday things. And this was New York, so everyone was always moving, always sad, always happy, always eating things they shouldn't be eating. And I answered, "Yes, Tom, you were still an asshole. And the East River is a dirty, muddy mess, except for that hour when it catches the sunlight just so and reminds me that beauty, even as it edges away from my still primitive soul, and despite what anyone else has ever said, is never a diminished thing." Let me, and this one is called, Stone Soul Picnic after the Laura Nero song. "The Stone Soul Picnic was where I first held your hand 30 years before you were born, as we watched a red wine and golden apple colored sunset that made us shiver slightly like swimmers rising from warm water into cool air. I was a sailor of ships, a flyer of kites, a child of old city streets on vacation during the summer of broken windows. I wrote stories that began with the word how and ended with the word because I didn't know how to say it any other way. And the years were like dry ice, melting, then turning into mist, into pink fog over the winding waters we followed as we brought our covers, our fires, and our black iron pots with cracked edges all covered with grease and fat. And the mist rose higher and higher, then rained back down on us with the fury of fists, and food grew scarce, and we grew tired and slow, and our thoughts turned to black and white like old TVs and old fading photographs. And I went to the woman with a loudly beating heart, breathing heavily like her, and asked, 'Can you show me the way to Bending Creek the next time it rains frogs in the afternoon?' will be very hungry by then, and their deep fried legs will make good eating on the red blanket on the green grass with the music playing like open-eyed love through a storm. Why, if we had their power to jump, we could see hazy or even clear over the mountains and in the mists of these strange unforeseen events. When land starts to shake and skies tremble and fall, we'll know what to do and how. We'll save ourselves, our tribe, our land, which follows us whichever way we go. Why, we might even save the world, but don't count on it, motherfucker. And a couple more. This is a long one and then a short one. This is called "The Interview with the Mountain." When I first came to interview the mountain, it said the hour was late, that it was too tired, that it doubted it had anything of significance to say, anything worthy of putting in print. The second time it said it didn't trust me, that I was a foreigner who would never understand its ways, who had his own agenda that would make the rivers, the ocean, even the deer and wildcats seem more important than they really were, and less vindictive and more fun. The third time we sat and stared at each other. I had brought along my lunch and I bit into my sandwich and sipped my iced tea as the mountains looked at me in silence, refusing to eat. The fourth time I brought a friend who drank whiskey and played songs on his violin, who asked the mountain what he thought about the moon, and the mountain just said that it didn't think about the moon and that it thought about the moon as often as it thought about us. The fifth time I brought a book, which I read silently to myself while the mountain slept until well past noon, when it said that it didn't believe the seasons were real. The changes in temperature, the drifting snow, and the turning of the leaves were created by men and women living in cities who had never even seen a mountain. The sixth time I took my wife and my daughter ran around chasing butterflies, while my wife and I breathed in deeply, looking at the blue of the sky, imagining the shapes of the animals. Not once did we try to speak to the mountain, and not once did we look at it. The seventh time I climbed slowly to the top and back down again with my eyes closed, waiting for the mountain to speak, finally to say something about its past, how it's not as tall as it once was, how none of us are growing, how nothing in the world grows for very long, and how the rivers betrayed him and the oceans shifted their weight. I went to sleep without thinking of rescuing him and without showing him how to swim or build a boat, and how the animals never taught him how to find cover or how to protect himself, and why it serves no purpose for man or moon or bird or flower for a mountain to speak when everything around him is falling. Then in the early morning, as the shadows took quick steps toward the city, I left and came back with a knife and fork, and I ate the mountain, breaking him apart into sand and rocks, gnawing on the pieces with my monstrous teeth, eating until I was full, until the mountain was all gone, because I live in the country now and no longer have the voices of the city or the cries of sirens echoing down dark streets or words of lesser wisdom to hold me back. And I love the slower pace of life here and the way flowers in their season take all the time they need to blossom. And this is one last short one, which I read in the last reading, but I lost the last two lines of it, so I couldn't finish it. So for this reading, I get to read the whole poem. This is called "For Lovers and Other Refugees of the Fascist State." This is from a series of sonnets that I've been writing since around the pandemic began. Love is like an element in its place on the periodic table, its properties made clear through comparisons to all the other elements. How easily love turns to liquid, the energy assumed in maintaining a gaseous state, the cold it takes to create a dense and fearsome mass. When solid, Love is where we live, for there's nothing we can carry from it in this form. When it's liquid, we travel to and from love the way one rambles west in one's youth to find fame, then east to find fortune. Now we live in the age of vapors, gasping for breath, running for the exits. In the middle of dim, rough days and cruel centuries, let our love be electric and our home a movable foundation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jose. So our next reader of the evening is Matthew Ussia.
Ah, there we go. Now I can speak. All right. Hello, everybody. Thanks to Joan and Chris and Halsey and everyone at White Whale. To be part of this series is a dream come true, especially on such a stacked lineup. So I got 9 poems for you tonight, some from my book, The Red Glass Cat, some new. For those of you unfamiliar with my work, that gives you 4 poems to figure out if you like me. And if you don't, we're already in the 5th poem and your ordeal is more than half over. So good to go. All right. This first one is called St. John Minadeo, and it's the story about how one of Pittsburgh's elementary schools got its name. Whenever I see a crossing guard's bright yellow raincoat, I think of St. John Minadeo. The car, brakes failed, rolling out of control down Hazelwood Avenue. The driver honking, flailing one arm out the window. John pushing the last classmate out of the way, a split second before martyrdom. This next poem is called At the Moment He Was Conceived. It's a true story, sort of, and it came to me in a dream. At the moment he was conceived, his father, who had paused at the Franciscan seminary, emptied himself after swimming in a sea of sheets and skin, saw his reflection in his wife's pupils. One could only hope the moment was not ruined, contemplating divine judgment over choosing the wrong kind of biblical ecstasy. The boy, whose only memory of his father was set in a cancer ward, told me stories of an evil stepfather and the 1,000 invisible daggers passed around the dinner table. The boy, years later, at the boy's wedding, his mother told me the story of the time he called on a landline from the very same college campus that separated them decades prior. His voice was so much like his father's, she momentarily forgot what era it was and who she was talking to. At that moment, in my mind, I heard the sound of a branch breaking. This is one of my COVID poems. It's called Schema. After the toilet paper was hoarded and the hand sanitizer gone, they lined up maskless in the courthouse lobby for concealed carry permits. That's around when they sent the bombers to fly over the hospitals so that millions of dollars of jet fuel exhaust could bless our healthcare warriors with taxpayer pennies from heaven not squandered on ventilators. I forget when care became an act of war. Pretty sure it was before pizza delivery became essential and the decision that there was no reasonable way to cancel football. Because in a crisis, we can only do what we know. This next one is called Arriving in Westmont. It's a Johnstown poem, and you'll be able to buy this or read this in an anthology that's coming out in 2025, which is a long time to still be alive, I think, in these days. It's called Arriving in Westmont. My grandparents always wanted to move up here, become hilltoppers, a nickname to show the mill rats below who won't be drowning in the next flood. But for the looming fear of seasonal layoffs, the closest my grandparents ever got were graves in Grandview that I could never find on my own. Settling for a West End duplex, he worked first shift, waiting for the bus before dawn, losing his hearing in a shower of sparks. My grandmother got bit by a rat at the bakery where she worked. I lost the socialist campaign buttons I found in their attic. On my way to pick up a dinner that to them a wedding feast, for me is boring Saturday night takeout. My uncalloused hands sign away what would have been a week's wages after the tip. I've worked hard to get here, but never at the mouth of a blast furnace. I was born during the last great flood, a long distance call from my mother as she was going into labor, followed by catastrophe. A local call 3 weeks later, a ham radio operator from Perth Amboy, New Jersey, speaking to someone in Morrellville, claiming he was a friend of my grandfather who wanted to know if I was a girl or a boy. His health failing, they had to bring his first grandson as soon as I was ready to travel. When my parents called from the opposite end of the turnpike, he turned his chair around with his back to the television. For 5 hours, he stared at the door, waiting until he could hold me for the first and last time. All right, this is a new one called The Gift. My first true moment of despair was in second grade when I fell into the toilet. I didn't realize the seat was up. This is when I learned what it meant to feel worthless as I sunk into the cold water. Later, watching 3-2-1 Contact, eating a TV dinner, they got into the death of the sun, and possessed by the image of the frozen sky falling on my little grave on an empty earth, I started screaming with a mouthful of mashed potatoes, inconsolable. I'm known for a cynicism that works its way into every conversational subject. Morbid fun facts about the gigantic penises demons are supposed to have, and how we could never see a quasar coming at the speed of light, turning us all into clouds of superheated gas. Ran into a former student the other day who still remembers the time I told her class about the liquefied remains of a corpse lost in air freight. I think the lesson was something about how to use a semicolon. But when you've lost sleep over the second law of thermodynamics, it's always time to have all the sex you can and get the fastest car. Enjoy every sandwich. They say I'm fun at parties, but I just want to help my friends by teaching them that it's okay to die. All right, this next one is called What It's Like to Lose a Parent to Fox News, and it goes out to anyone who can relate. Things were supposed to be different after sailing past the age your parents were when you first met them, different at least for the one that's still around. But an adulthood of mature hopes, dreams, and triumphs was not to be. Childhood forgotten, no confessions, no reflections. Phone calls from mom last about 10 minutes. Small talk about the weather and football before the big immigrant takeover and the Muslim communists that Biden put in charge of the government. 10 minutes before, sorry, Ma, I think there's somebody at the door. This next one is called Presidential History, and it hits harder if you do the math. On October 22nd, 1976, in the shadow of Nixon, was the final debate between Ford and Carter. And in the days before cable, when the president was on TV, the president was on every TV. How could this clash of titans inspire anything but a wave of joyless missionary sex? A contractual exchange in loveless marriages, like the handing over of grocery money. I was born July 21st, 1977, in a hospital named after John F. Kennedy. Do the math. Anyway. All right. This is the penultimate poem. It's called The Secret City. There's a reference in here. So for those of you not in the know, there was a spot on the Allegheny Riverfront in pre-gentrified Lawrenceville called Certain Death. It's where punks had generator shows. Then the condos came. All right. Punk mass ends with a sign of peace between friends and a five passed across the merch table to help the touring bands find the shadows of Cleveland or Philadelphia. Out of the rock room with a cloud of secondhand smoke into cool, thick night air, the silence of Polish Hill, the ringing ocean of sounds found inside a car the seconds before it starts. This is the skyline of the secret city, whose citizenry are eager to trade sleep for a spectacle on a school night. On the ride home, shows pass into memory, on their way to legend. The tour tape on my front seat, permanent artifact of the intimacies of the scene, bands ripping holes in time on these breathless nights. Tomorrow, I'll be in a meeting to compose a strategic plan, trying to impress the administration and counting the hours to the next show, trying to relive what I just saw. The lights on a rain-wet Penn Avenue blink yellow as the thousands of slumbering domestic dramas of the East End float by. I push the gas a little harder on the way to my own domestic tranquility, Nell and Libby waiting warm in our bed. I will be greeted with a mumbled, "Did you have fun?" from Nell 4 hours before her alarm goes off, and a drowsy wag of Libby's tail. But for now, I'm burning with the streetlights in this clandestine night. There are, of course, other sights to be seen this late. That time I saw Fox crossing Forbes, street racers on the parkway, all-night diner carnivals, certain death skinny dippers, dreams and philosophies whispered on porches. And there are, of course, deeper secrets later nights, basement doors begging to be knocked on, scenes wilder, impenetrable. I could tell you more, but everybody's got to find their own way in past the gates. All right, the last poem, it's called Supermarket in Homestead, Pennsylvania. It's a poem about a poem I didn't write, but maybe it's because I grew as a person. Oh, what thoughts I have of you this afternoon, Allen Ginsberg, as I immerse myself into grumpy middle age and the waterfront Giant Eagle. It started in the parking lot, abnormally full for a weekday afternoon, when I remember with slight dread, it's the first Friday of the month. I was busted right at the front door by a food demo specialist hawking oranges. She gave me my first hit of a real blood orange, and a doorway opened to a deep and dark world of low acid with a hint of berry aftertaste. I was hooked for life right before she told me they were all out. And it continued. They changed the design of the plastic bags for the bread I buy, and the new layout. I used to know this store like the back of my hand, I grumble. So crowded. Where the hell are the vegetarian refried beans? The kind of coffee I like was discontinued too. I can't read the handwriting on my own list. Crisscrossing the aisles several times, a poem started to build in my mind. This store is a trough where misery feeds itself. Of course, to write this means humanity is a sty, and I'm just the prime porker. Then I noticed the woman next to me started to dance with her full cart to the Whitney Houston song cascading from above. Someone's grandmother, like my own, 20 years gone now, babushka and all, counts money in a white bank envelope. My cashier wears a union pin, reclaiming this ground from Frick's army of Pinkertons once again. The promises of payday and the New Deal realized. It can be so easy to forget about my place at the common table of the human family. And to do so is to ruin one of the greatest words in the English language, groceries. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you for putting up with me.
Thank you so much, Matt. And our final reader of the evening is none other than Michael Sims.
Can you hear me? All right. Thanks, Halsey. Thanks for being here, everybody. I feel privileged to read with Bob, Jose, and Matt, and I really appreciate the work that Joan and Chris and Anna are doing to make this Hemingway's White Whale series happen. Tonight, I'm taking a break from my usual poems about death and darkness, and I'm going to read 4 poems about joy, hope, and acceptance. And they are part of my new collection, American Ash, published by Ragged Sky Press in Princeton. One of my proudest achievements was teaching both of my children how to swim at our neighborhood pool in Pittsburgh. My daughter Leah learned to swim when she was just 4 years old. The summer you learned to swim. The summer you learned to swim was the summer I learned to be at peace with myself. In May, you were afraid to put your face in the water. But by August, I was standing in the pool once more when you dove in, then retreated to the wall, saying, "You forgot to say sugar." So I said, "Come on, sugar, you can do it." And you pushed off and swam to me and held on, laughing. Your hair stuck to your cheeks. You hiccuped with joy and swam off again. And I dove in too, trying new things. I tried not giving advice. I tried waking early to pray. I tried not rising in anger. Watching you, I grew stronger. Your courage washed away my fear. All day, I worked hard thinking of you. In the evening, I walked the long hill home. You were at the top, waving your small arms, pittering down the slope to me, and I lifted you high, so high to the moon. That summer, all the world was soul and water, light glancing off peaks. You learned the turtle, the cannonball, the froggy, and the flutter, and I learned to stand and wait for you to swim to me. Here's a poem I wrote when I was just 25 years old, which was a few years ago, but I still like it, and so I included it in my new book. It's called Evening in the Adirondacks. Always it will be late summer in your mind. Birches give off a full and dark light with a motion you know will abide and return every evening. You are changed by small things. An elm seed spins to earth, and like your talent for the cello, the possibilities remain enclosed. Being ordinary makes you a hero. Sweeping the porch, looking at the sky, you become more than yourself. The solace for being dull is being perfectly at ease with the world. All afternoon, the afternoon sails in and out the window, and the first star starts the lake singing. A few years after my mother died, I returned to her house on the Llano River in Central Texas. And sitting on the back patio of her house, my father was still living there, sitting back on the back patio of her house, I was supposed to be correcting the proofs of a book I was editing, but my heart wasn't in it. So instead I wrote this poem, and so I called it Uncorrected Proof. Uncorrected proof. My mother, who was much wiser than I knew, used to say, "Make sure there are mistakes in everything you do, so the gods won't be jealous." And sure enough, I find my mistakes spreading like blue bonnets on the dry plain beside the Llano River, where we spread her ashes with the ashes of my father, whom she loved. She loved this imperfect man and found beauty in his mistakes. Imagine, and the river carried her ashes down to the Brazos and the Gulf of Mexico. And who knew she'd come back as a breeze on this patio. It is springtime in the hill country, and the blue bonnets are like a blanket on the dry land. And the Indian paintbrushes dab their reds and yellows as the shadow of the storm passes over them. I once knew a composer who listened so intently when I spoke, he didn't hear me. The grief passed long ago, and what's left is sunlight and shadow taking turns. In the morning, the storm builds. In the afternoon, the rain passes. A translator famous for his versions of Akhmatova said he was trapped between heaven and earth. Imagine being so in love, the mistakes we make keep us on the ground, imperfect and happy. Which was it? Rain falling on dry sand, steam rising in the valley, the mountain turning blue in the gathering dark? Or was it rosy-fingered silence? As my friend Jose says, yes, metaphors are things with sharp edges that can hurt you. Most days I'm sleepwalking, passing trees without seeing them, hearing birds and neighbors who want nothing more than acknowledgement, a simple good morning or a nod. And then, as if for the first time ever, I'm awake. This doesn't happen often, just every now and then, like sunlight on a patio with bougainvillea, a profusion of hibiscus, and a scent of salt carried by a breeze from the ocean hundreds of miles away. The last poem I'll read this evening is called Consider the Hummingbird, which is a meditation on God and love and, well, everything else too. The poem includes a true anecdote. This is a trigger warning. The poem includes a true anecdote about a sexually precocious 5-year-old who looks up his teacher's dress. Consider the hummingbird. Consider the hummingbird, how like the mind it is, flitting bee balm to daylily, 1,200 heartbeats per minute, 200 wing beats per second in a universe 12 billion years old. In pursuit of love, the hummingbird can dive 60 miles per hour in the courtship dance, 250 breaths per minute, forward, backward. Its red throat is not pigment in the feathers, but a refraction of light, like the shimmering of intelligence we see everywhere in the garden. And the child, this would be me at nap time in kindergarten, lying on a mat on the floor in the darkened room, 50 other kids, Miss Verlaine standing high heels right next to my head. Face up, I silently slid my mat toward her feet until my head was exactly between her high heels, and I looked up her nylon legs, looking up, up, up into darkness between her legs, then slid my mat back and pretended to sleep. But little Alice Stuyvesant saw me, and all afternoon she looked at me, and I didn't know whether she would tell the teacher, but I didn't care because I'd looked into the darkness and survived. And looking up into the night sky is like that. The mystery is you can't see much, but you imagine everything. Even God, if you want to call it that, this intelligence, this cunt, this darkness we live inside and is everywhere, even here in the garden where the hummingbird moves from daylily to bee balm, its small feet tucked behind its muscled chest with more than 250 breaths per minute, its wings beating 200 flaps per second, its heart the size of a peanut squeezing out 1,200 beats per minute, and how Much faster is the mind, with neurons sending electrons across 30 trillion synapses every second. And how much faster than the mind is the mind of the universe, which as night comes, we see the stars and the stuff between the stars, the living tissue of reality that gives us this hummingbird, the whirring of its wings and the glint of red at its throat, a deep mystery in the mere fact we experience the world as whole and beautiful with color and music and joy in the redness of red, the taste of mint, the stars popping out like musical notes. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michael. That was absolutely incredible. Thank you to all of our readers. I'm going to pass things over to Joan to round things off.
Okay. I want to thank you all so much for reading tonight, Matt and Bob and Michael and Jose. There's that line in Michael's poem about most days we are sleepwalking. And I just feel like for many of us, we have been sleepwalking about a year and a half. No, and that it is just a joyous moment to be able to come together and to hear this extraordinary poetry. And I just want to thank Chris and Anna and Halsey. And I want to thank everyone who's listening in tonight. I want to also say that we're going to have a chance to post all this, because these are poems that are so wonderful and dazzling, with so many leaps, so many things where you've got to go back and really, I've got to hear that again. How did they do that? How these guys do it? I really hope you'll not only just hear it tonight, but go back and listen to these readings again and find a way to get yourself copies of the books of these poets, especially. These are wonderful poems. They're wonderful books. And I wanted just to add that in two weeks, we will be back with on Tuesday, June the 29th, with Daniela Buccelli, Paula Corso, Jason Irwin, who's on tonight, Rachel Menes, and Fred Shaw. And so we are at the halfway mark tonight. We have four more weeks to go, and maybe we can be live next year. But I would have to say it was especially wonderful to be able to hear our Pittsburgh-based poets, but to be able to hear the work of Jose. It might have been harder to do it if we'd had to get him to try to talk him into driving. So I just think there's some opportunities here. And we're happy to have been able to take advantage of. Thank you all. You take care. Stay safe. All good wishes.
Good night, everybody.